All right, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Double Nine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Sam Lau here with Eric Dahl.
Hey, hey, hey.
All right, Eric, it's just after the close here on February 16th, 2024. About to enter into this long weekend here to celebrate President's Day, and all the markets will be closed that day, so we'll be taking that day off as well. But a lot to go over this week. There's a lot of happenings in the markets, a lot of red across the screen here, but more importantly, a lot of that was impacted based on what we saw here in macro land. But before I let you go off on the macro side of things, Dahl, I'll kick us off on what happened this past week in financial markets, starting here with the S&P 500. That's down almost half a point on the week-to-date measure there. Down 35 basis points to be precise. And on the year to date, it's still up just over 5% for total return through, again, February 16th here. A little bit of a mixed bag. It seems like we had seven sectors of the S&P 500 in the green here, but despite that, we still on a broad-based index level close in the red. But leading the charge was energy and materials, both up over 2%, with energy leaving the way up 2.7%. Materials up 2.4%. So anyone that had specific exposure to those sectors would have probably outperformed this week, given the fact that those two sectors combined, I believe, make up less than 10% of the entire weight of the S&P 500. They're both in the low single digits in terms of the amount of market cap that they represent within the broader based index. But alongside there, you also have financials up and utilities up both over 1.5%. You also had healthcare and industrials up about 1% and consumer staples up 20 basis points. Leading the way down have been some of the, the drivers of some of the performance that we saw throughout 2023 and the early part of 2024. Those are the sectors that really contain the names of the seven Magnificent Seven stocks there. These are comm services, consumer discretionary, and technology. Those were all in the red. With technology down the most, over 2.5% this week, consumer staples and consumer discretionaries, communication services, I should say, and consumer discretionary, both down about half a point there. And then finally, you have real estate down 15 basis points. So really, when you take a look at it, the leaders of 2024 in terms of the sectors became the laggards this week, at least. Moving down, you kind of see the continuation of the theme on a year-to-date basis with the large cap sector up about 5% as represented by the Russell 1000 on the year-to-date basis, Russell 2000 representing the smaller cap names up about half a point. And then for the growth versus value, similar type theme again from 2023 with the Russell 1000 growth leading the way up about 7.5% on the year-to-date basis while you have 2% positive on the Russell 1000 value for the year to date. But you kind of maintain that reversal of that theme and that narrative that led us through 2023 with this week when you're taking a look at Russell 1000 large caps down 50 basis points while their small cap counterparts are up 1.3% for the week. And similarly with growth was down about 1.4% week to date versus value, which is up 80 basis points. So a little bit of a change in leadership there, at least for this week to date period here. Moving over to fixed income land, I take a look across here and I see yields moving up across the curve here with the 2-year treasury note up 16 basis points in yield to close the week at 4.64. 10-year treasury note up 11 basis points in yield to close the week at 4.28. And the bond, the 30-year treasury bond, is up 7 basis points to close the week at 4.44%. There's a lot of volatility here intra-week, both on the treasury yields as well as the S&P 500. As I look at the screen now, I mean, there's a big reversal. We started out the day looking positive on the week-to-date basis, given a strong early session here in the S&P 500 today, but that has since reversed within that space. So today it looks like the S&P 500 is down about 50 basis points on Friday alone here. But similarly, when we take a look at what yields did across the week, I mean, we had CPI on Tuesday, and on that day, on the 2-year treasury and the 10-year note, on intraday moves, we had about 20 basis points between the low point yields and the high point yields on that intraday. So a lot of market participants are here are trying to figure out what's going on with regards to the impact from inflation weight, but I'll let you get more into that later when you hit the macro side of things. But what this all meant for the broad-based bond market as measured by the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate, that was down half of a point on a week-to-date basis. Year-to-date, it's down just under 2%. Looking across the board for this week here, in contrast to what I just said about the equity markets and the bond markets, it seems like one of the leaders of 2023 is also a leader of this week, as well as on the year-to-date basis, and that's the floating rate debt side. Represented by bank loans. So again, you have the floating rate side, but then you also have the down in credit type of assets there for representing in the fixed income space. When I take a look at the traditional sectors, those sectors underlying the Bloomberg aggregate, the ones that are more sensitive to interest rate moves, those are the sectors that were down the most. You have the IG corporate credit, U.S. Treasury market, and agency mortgage-backed securities all down about 50 to 60 basis points for the week. But also there with high yield, you also have that down about 60 basis points on the week. And then finally, to round it up, we had emerging market sovereign debt down 30 basis points on the week, it looks like, to date basis right here. So with that kind of look across the fixed income market, it looks like only bank loans right now is positive on that year-to-date basis. Everything else is in the red for the year-to-date for the other cohort for the fixed income market. Moving across the board here to the commodity side of things, commodities are also in the red this week. The Bloomberg Commodity Index, a broad basket of commodity futures representing the five sectors of the commodity market there, it was down 60 basis points on the week-to-date basis, kind of in line with the year-to-date performance of the fixed income market. That's down 1.7% versus that 1.9% on the Bloomberg aggregate. So kind of neck and neck there. But when we take a look at the individual components that we like to look at with regards to the front month future prices, WTI crude oil up 3% on the week, just shy of $80. It's at $79.17 per barrel of WTI crude oil. On the front month price basis, it's up 10.5% on the year-to-date basis here. So it's closed the week at kind of the higher end of the more recent range here, and we'll see if it gets over that into the $80 handle next week on that shortened week because of President's Day. Gold, on the other hand, is kind of doing the other side. It's trying to hang on to this level of 2,000 per troy ounce. Right now it's at $2,011.50 a troy ounce, down 60 basis points over the previous week and down about 3%. So not really liking the inflation data and what that might mean for monetary policy as we look forward to the macro section. But with that, Eric, we did have pretty much, I guess, what we've been calling inflation print week, that alongside some data from the consumer side of things. So do you want to kick us off on what happened on the macro land?
Absolutely. As you alluded to, this wasn't a big inflation week, but let's start it off with the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index for January. It came in at 89.9, decreasing from the prior of 91.9 and below the estimate. Alluding to the inflation prints that were going to come out later, the NFIB chief economist said, "Small business owners continue to make appropriate business adjustments in response to the ongoing economic challenges they're facing. In January, optimism among small business owners dropped as inflation remains a key obstacle on Main Street." And we'll use that as our lead in to CPI, which was a major market mover. You saw, as Sam mentioned, large repricings in both equity and credit markets and bond markets due to the inflation print. So CPI month over month for January came in at positive 0.3%, which was above the estimate by 10 basis points. That left CPI on a year-over-year basis for January at 3.1%, which was an increase over the estimate of 2.9. You know, and It was still a decrease from the prior of 3.4, but it really kind of shocked the market because all of the narrative out there is that the inflation dragon's been killed by the Federal Reserve and it's over. Well, it's a little more stubborn than that. Kind of digging into the hood there, some of the drivers that kept headline inflation above where estimates thought it was going to be were core services. And kind of looking at the core CPI, which just excludes food and energy, month over month, those were up 0.4%. And looking at the core CPI on a year-over-year basis, it was up 3.9%. And both of those levels were higher than the estimates. Kind of digging into the details there to see what was driving it. One of the things you saw is you saw a strong increase from core services, 0.5%. That was 0.28% the previous month. So you saw an increase there. OER, owner's equivalent rent, was also strong, which and you saw it at 0.6% month over month, up from 0.4% month over month previously. Medical care services was strong at 0.7% month over month. And transportation services went to 1.0% month over month from 0.1%. So goods detracted again in January. So it's the services dragon that's really still there. It's a two-headed dragon, this inflation beast. The Fed has seemingly got the goods inflation under control, which you can kind of see in the import prices that we talked about last week. But in terms of services inflation, it's still there. Well, what do you think, Sam?
I mean, it seems to be the case as well. I mean, we were just looking at a chart earlier today as we were trying to lay out some macro themes here at the on the cross asset team, and we were looking at the ISM prices paid for the services component, and it's a pretty interesting chart, especially on the pop in the level there over the for the most recent period of January. I don't recall the actual number that we had, but there's a pretty significant rise. I want to say it was around in the 50 handle in December, and then it ended in January for the print of around 64. So that seems to corroborate what we're seeing here with regards to the services component or the services dragon, I guess, as you know, if you're going to call it that, with regards to CPI. It's one of those things where you have to go back to what Jerome Powell had been saying, in the past, where he says, the risk of doing too little at that point outweighed the risk of doing too much. So, the fact that he may have pivoted back in, or it did seem like he pivoted back in December based on his rhetoric, but then, subsequent governors came out and just walked him back, so to speak, from that position, that seems to have merit today still.
Yeah, definitely. And sorry for our listeners there. I had a little bit of a kind of chronological confusion there. We did have import prices drop this week, but it was on Thursday yesterday. That information, the year-over-year import price data came in at minus 1.3%, which, kind of is in line with this narrative we're discussing of okay, some of the input costs have come down, import prices are coming down, but we're seeing stubbornness in the services side of inflation. The month-over-month import price data was actually up, though, so don't let that go unnoticed. We saw it increase by 0.8% in January, where the estimate was for it to be flat. And the prior there was minus 0.7%, but still declining on a year-over-year basis. Surprise pop there, something to keep an eye on, but definitely big inflation week and some interesting signals coming in. We'll keep you guys attuned as we get more information. We'll get the PCE in 2 weeks, which is the Fed's favored measure of inflation. So going on Thursday, we also got retail sales, and that was a really weak print. The retail sales for January came in at minus 0.8%, whereas the prior was positive 0.4, and it was a pretty big miss across the board. if you dig into it a little more to try and understand what was happening there, eating and drinking services, which are about a 14% weight in the index, they were up 0.7% month over month. So that's positive. But gasoline stations were down 0.13%, which you could argue, if people are paying less for gas, maybe that's a good thing. But nonetheless, it drug the index down. Non-store retailers also dropped 14 basis points on a contribution basis, 0.8% month over month, on a headline basis. So that was a pretty big drag right there. Maybe people were just tapped out and they use their subscription delivery services to order everything they needed. I mean, who knows? We'll have to keep our eyes on this, but that was a pretty big shift considering that that's been a positive driver for the past few months. Building materials also declined. So those kind of people interested in home improvements and contracting work kind of, and that was a big drag on the index, pulling it down by 23 basis points. Minus 4.1% month over month. It is January, so you could say, people are just hunkered down for the winter months. But you get leaks, you get problems in these winter months. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on. And then vehicles and parts also fell 1.7% month over month, which pulled the index down by 32 basis points. So all in, retail sales was lackluster, and it was driven by declines in non-store retailers, building materials, and vehicles and parts. Those were the main impediments, and gasoline stations, which from my point of view is kind of a wash because people spending less on gas is probably good for them on balance. Any insights there, Mr. Lau?
Yeah, I do recall that Ryan Kimmel on our macro asset allocation team putting out a note around retail sales. And the thing that kind of jumped out on me to me was the fact that the revisions to economic data continued, right? So what we saw here with the retail sales is there's a cumulative effect of the, I believe it's the past two prior months being revised down by a cumulative 50 basis points to that. Led to the impact on a year-over-year basis. So, of just having that, it was 0.6% if memory serves on the year-over-year number for retail sales on January over January number. So, pretty much, I would call that flat over the previous year. But we'll see what you bring up. I mean, you do bring up a good point that perhaps there is some weather-related impact here on the retail sales component, particularly as you mentioned building materials. I start thinking about the weather was a concern there, so I'm not sure how many people wanted to get out there here in the on the West Coast, at least when we had that, what was it called, the atmospheric river coming here, just the torrential downpours that we had. It seemed like every day in January and early part of February, but then also the folks on the West Coast and everywhere in between had some pretty extreme weather as well. So, I mean, these are pretty volatile data sets that we get in, particularly around retail sales. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out over the next few months as well. But it is an interesting data point to look at. As we pointed out in a few podcasts ago, where we did cover retail sales, the control group there is the component that leads into the consumer side of GDP as measured through the personal consumer. Personal consumption expenditures basket there. And as we know, the consumer side of the economy is about anywhere somewhere around 60 to 65% of the total economy. So certainly we want to see if how the US consumer stands, and we get it through these periodic reports.
Yeah, that's a good point. The retail sales control group for January was down 0.4%. So not a good start to the year from a consumption standpoint, looking forward to the Q1 GDP. Maybe the consumer will open their pocket in February and March. We'll just have to wait and see, and we'll keep you guys apprised. Initial jobless claims for the week ending February 10th came in at 212,000. Nothing really to see there. Continuing claims ticked up a bit to 1,895,000. So that's a trend I don't like to see. I don't like to see continuing claims continue to creep higher. So if that, I wouldn't say it's at a concerning level, but it's not positive to see it to continue to march upward slowly, one step at a time. On Thursday, we also got industrial production for January, which came in minus 0.1%, which isn't the greatest print, and manufacturing has been in a tough spot for a while, so I wouldn't say that's new news to the market. The capacity utilization rate was 78.5%, a decline from the previous print of 78.7. The PPI dropped on Friday, and the PPI month over month for January came in at 0.3%, which was well above the estimate of 0.1% and well above the prior minus 0.1%. So that was another kind of inflation shock. And you saw that again in rates markets today and in equities. You saw a decline in both equities and rate sensitive debt today as people kind of, had digested the CPI report that came out on Tuesday. There was a little bit of a relief rally on Wednesday. But, today on Friday, just that PPI number definitely took some wind out of the sails of the inflation is over camp. Looking at the PPI final demand number year over year, on a year over year basis, it came in at 0.9%, which was above the estimate by 30 basis points. The prior was 1%. So slight increases there. I'm not trying to be alarmist here, though. I mean, these weren't huge numbers on the PPI. They were just were above the estimates, and that's what caused the market to react, but not the right direction. So I and you saw that with the kind of interest rate probability forecast. If you look at the market and tease out the probability of rate hikes, they've been pushed forward. They've been pushed forward, and it looks like we're gonna get three cuts all in the second half of the year, if the market's to be believed. But it seems like the hope of a early cut is getting put to is getting put down with each of these kind of stubborn inflation prints.
Yeah, and I would say for clarity, by push forward here, we mean that they're being pushed out farther out into the year, whereas before people were pricing in March. A 25 basis point cut in March, now it's been pushed out, looks like, until the June meeting, which is something that I know Jeff Sherman here, our deputy CIO, has been calling for quite a few weeks now, with regards to when he was thinking about the first rate cut. So kudos to Jeff if that ends up playing out. But as of right now, it seems like the market is tilting towards his side. But with that, let's jump into the topic of the week. We did get a question this week from a listener by the name of Joe, and he was asking us to comment on the U.S. equity market concentration that we've seen both through 2023 and maybe even before that, going into kind of the tail end of 2022, and we're certainly seeing it here starting the year 2024 as well. But yes, his comment on that. But specifically, when have we seen this kind of concentration in the top 10 names? And historically, what has followed once we see this level of concentration? And then he cites some information that he received from the JP Morgan researcher there. And let's see here, asking that a steep rise in concentration and narrow market leadership has historically reversed, with the S&P 500 equal weighted index outperforming the market cap weighted index after periods of these big rises in concentration of the top 10 names. And then later on, he says, specifically without any research to back this up, his intuition says that the recent concentration could be a function of the rise of indexing, momentum, and growth factors, and then also, the monetary support since the GFC. So he wanted to get our thoughts around that, and we thought we would oblige. I do apologize. We did notice that we got the question a few weeks ago, so we just wanted to get to it today. So sorry for the delay, Joe. But to kick it off, I'll provide a little bit of background here for our listeners. I also saw a GPM piece that referenced some of this concentration. It wasn't the same one that you saw, Joe, but this one came from their asset management team. And here, this piece looked at the S&P 500 constituents as of December 31st, 2023. And from there, they looked back over the course of the year, going to the first trading day of 2023. And from that, they identified what they perceived to be the top 10 market cap names on day one of 2023. And they looked to see what it looked like by that year end. So as of December of 2023, what they found was that top 10 market cap by that methodology accounted for about a third of the total S&P 500 market cap by those top 10 names. With that, those top 10 names also contributed to about 25% of the overall earnings for the S&P 500 in 2023. Over the course of the year, in terms of the total return, the S&P 500 returned just over 26%, but those top 10 market cap names contributed to over 85% of that total return, with the remaining 490 plus type of names within the S&P 500, and the others, so to speak, contributing to the remaining 15% of that return there. With regards to valuations at that year-end period, the top 10 market cap names had a price to equities earnings ratio of 26.9 versus 19.5 on the S&P 500, and the remaining 490 plus names had a PE multiple of 17.1. So, obviously very skewed to those top 10 names, but I think a lot of that is somewhat intuitive and to be expected when you start looking at the constituents of those top 10. And we do have our compliance on here, so I'm going to be a little bit careful in what I say and don't say in terms of names. I'm not going to talk about the names, but here, people affectionately have given the moniker of Magnificent Seven to seven out of those 10 names on the top market cap as being a big driver of returns as well. And so when we take a look at the Magnificent Seven, they're all technology and AI related names, for the most part there. Given that kind of descriptor, it's the elevated PE is, I guess, to be somewhat expected. I was reading something from Jim Bianco to the other day, and he was saying the price to earnings ratio for those Magnificent Seven had a PE ratio of around 40 there. So, I mean, again, I say it's somewhat intuitive because these names, given the tech and AI kind of name around it, is going to be representative of the growth sector or the growth type of names there, which command higher multiples relative to their cohort there. So, that would bring the overall PE of that 20 of the top 10 market cap names up to that 26.9 that I mentioned to you before. But one other interesting fact is, as I said, that the top 10 names accounted for about a third of the total S&P 500 market cap. The Magnificent Seven accounts for about 25% of the total market cap, so certainly a big chunk there of the overall S&P 500. And something that you and I and also Jeff have been talking about over the course of pretty much the run-up here, Eric, is the fact that within these Magnificent Seven names, we like to break down the performance as we do each week here on Minutes into the sectors. And when we take a look at the sectors that contain these seven names, technology, comm services, and consumer discretionary, those were all by far and away the biggest performers in 2023, with technology leading the way up over 55%, comm services next at 53%, and consumer discretionary up 40%. The next best performer was industrials at 18%. So a pretty big dispersion there, and this has led to a lot of the concentration that Joe was talking about, and the industry has really been talking about with regards to the U.S. equity market as represented by the S&P 500. So with regards to Joe's kind of second part of his question, or more or less a statement, I do agree with Joe on the idea that a lot of this concentration is a function of perhaps indexing on a passive basis, as it connotes. But also given the fact that with the S&P 500 being a market cap weighted index, I think that's a big contributor there from the momentum side of things as well. But most passive equity indices out there that people are gravitating to, especially on the retail basis, they are market cap weighted, and that by nature is inherently momentum biased there. A lot of it is the larger, more well-recognized names start to snowball in size as more money goes into these higher capitalized names, based on their growing weight. It becomes capitalization over valuation, growth over value from that perspective. But also beyond that, I mean, if you start thinking about the way that the market has really changed in terms of investability, there's been a more proliferation or more usage of sector-based indices as well. And I think that's also added to this concentration effect because today investors can, select various sectors that they want to get exposure to. So in this case, you know, if people are trying to get that Magnificent Seven type of exposure, you know, they could also do it either by the single names, or they can do it by the sectors represented by the technology, the communication services, and the consumer discretionary that I just went over previously, just to get that exposure to that current narrative that's in place. So with that, I mean, you can get a more concentrated expression of that Magnificent Seven trade than just going into something broad-based like the S&P 500. But at the same time, you're also adding diversification away from just investing in those seven single names by themselves. So they do offer some a level of attractiveness to certain investors out there. And since that, you know, these sector indices themselves, a lot of the vehicles based on them are also market cap weighted. This also supports the idea of concentration at the top names of the S&P 500. But I think, you know, in addition to that, just on top of this idea of passive market cap or just indexing, you have other soft drivers within there as well. And these are some of the themes that we've talked about here in the minutes, as well as the Sherman Show podcast when we were running that. But there's a strong narrative, you know, at hand that oftentimes drives investor sentiment. And the narrative today is something that could persist for a while, because when you think about artificial intelligence as being a driver of some of this growth we saw most recently, I mean, AI is in its relative infancy. So you have that. You have this growing view that the U.S. perhaps can avoid or sidestep a recession. And at the same time, it's something that we've been talking about here as well, is just the idea that probably the next step in terms of the directionality of rate hikes or cuts is going to be lower rates in the future via the cuts. All of these things added together kind of gives strength to this positive investor sentiment around this thematic trade of the Magnificent Seven, or you know, looking at the concentrated nature of the S&P 500. So, you know, taking all this stuff together, it lends to a very supportive backdrop for growth stocks like the Magnificent Seven to continue, you know, for until they don't, basically. But oftentimes, you know, these things, or you know, these growth type of stocks are bought on the expectation that earnings will grow into their price. But I guess just one final note on this before I kick it over to you, Eric, is, you know, when we think about it, this power of the narrative and the sentiment, it's always important. But I think another thing that's added to this is, you know, being able to express these views is much easier today for almost everyone. It's this concept of the democratization of finance. And basically, when you take a look around, every investor, it doesn't matter if it's mom and pops, retail, novice investor, professional investor, if you will, smart money versus dumb money, that type of thing. Every investor has an easier, you know, and arguably better access to financial markets today. You know, we're talking about getting both on getting the information that you want on specific names, sectors, or ideas, but also putting money to work becomes much easier. So practically anyone can look up the underlying names of these, of, you know, whatever narrative is the hot topic, and, you know, they can get detailed information on the pros and cons of that company for free. And it's basically at their fingertips. You know, you can formulate an opinion based off of that, and then you can transact right on your phone, you know, without even getting off your couch and watching TV. So I think that adds to some of this concentration as you get more and more information, and the ability to transact on that information lends itself to this concentration over time. But, you know, Eric, you know, as I kick it over to you, I know, you know, you, me, you know, Mr. Mayberry, you know, our team really has been active around exploring the ideas and the of potential benefits of allocating away from just kind of an S&P 500 based, you know, straight market cap weighted broad based index, you know, given some of the things that we have on offer here at DoubleLine. And within that includes the concept of, you know, utilizing things like sector rotation to try to find better valuation, you know, within the 11 sectors of the S&P 500. But also this concept that Joe's talking about, the whole idea of market cap versus equal weight indices and the pros and cons on that. And I know you did some work on this recently on relative performance of the equal weighted indices over market cap, you know, as represented by the S&P 500, you know, over different periods. So do you want to let our listeners know what you found?
Yeah, definitely. And this was catalyzed by Joe's comments here. Did a little research, kind of got the data on concentration as a function of time in the S&P 500. And, you know, as Lau mentioned before, Mr. Lau mentioned before, we we've seen it move around. If you look at the top 10 weight in the S&P, the low was, let's call it, around 17, 16, and the high, right now it's around a third of the indexes in the top 10 names. One thing that I wanted to kind of explore is what does that mean for the future? And Mr. Lau touched on a lot of the kind of fundamental reasons why this current period might be different from past periods. But if you look over the course of history from like 1995 through the present, on average, when the S&P 500 has been more concentrated than its historical norm, that has implied that future returns have the potential to be lower. So in the S&P 500 compared to the S&P 500 equal weight. So that's a kind of interesting concept there. And people could dismiss that as, oh, it doesn't work anymore because of the many reasons Mr. Lau just talked about. This time is different. But historically, when concentration in the S&P has gotten rich relative to its average, it has foreboded an outperformance of the S&P 500 equal weight in 3 years into the future. So it isn't like it's going to happen tomorrow thing, but if you're in a period of massive concentration, that's definitely an opportunity for investors to diversify their portfolios if they're looking to maybe spread their capital around instead of hoping the momentum train continues to go forward. And like anything, nobody knows the future here, but that's what the historical data has shown.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it just comes back to this whole idea of whether or not you think the there'll be a change in leadership, right? I mean, going forward after this incredible run-up that we saw in the Magnificent Seven or the top 10 names here, but at some point you just have to ask yourself, how long can it continue? The idea of spreading the chips around into areas that might look better on an actual valuation basis starts to make a little bit more sense as the momentum ball, the pendulum starts to shift there, looking into some of these other opportunities that we think are relevant around equal weight indices or just even this idea of sector rotation. But hopefully, Joe, that gives you something to think about. But of course, down the road, as always, as we always invite all of our guests who submit topics a week, if we didn't hit deep enough there, just let us know and we'll try to dig up some more information for you. But hopefully you found that helpful. Yeah, so
And
with
with
that, we'll go ahead and move on to the things to keep an eye on. It looks like a pretty light week, both in terms of number of days that we'll be in the office, as well as the number of data prints are going to come out. But on Tuesday, February 20th, we'll have the leading economic index come out with the data there. And we know that we do see that as a pretty reliable indicator of as a recession signal. And right now, on a year-over-year basis, it's certainly been suggesting that there should be a recession already, or if not already, around the corner. But right now, on the month-over-month basis, it's estimated to be negative 0.3% relative to the prior month of negative 0.1%. So a little bit of more deceleration there. On Wednesday, 21st, we'll get the FOMC minutes. We'll see the highly revised and redacted version of what the FOMC might have been discussing at that meeting in January. And then, of course, we'll have the initial jobless claims and continuing claims, and we'll continue to watch it to see if there's any changes there. And then finally, on Thursday, we'll have the S&P Global Manufacturing as well as the services PMIs numbers there. And it looks like they're going to be a little bit lower, but both of them are going to remain in expansionary territory based on those measures there. And then finally, to wrap it up with just a little bit of housekeeping here, I wanted to make listeners aware as well on our YouTube channel for the Double Line YouTube channel. We'll have Jeff Sherman appearing on a recorded podcast with the folks over at Orion on, I believe it's Rusty's Weighing Machine podcast. There he's talking about the Goldilocks economy. And then we also have Morris Chen for his appearance on Fox. There he's talking about the commercial real estate market and the opportunities that he sees within that space. And then finally, we have the emerging markets team. They're talking about opportunities that they see in their respective market and what are some of the geopolitical risks out there. And then also on the LinkedIn page there that we have, we also can find Morris again with a somewhat recent piece on opportunities there in CRE on paper. If you don't want to see and listen to him on Fox there with Charles Payne. And we should also have our weekly blog up there at some point today as well for folks that want to check it out. And again, you don't need a subscription to check out that information on both the YouTube as well as the LinkedIn page there. So with that, that pretty much wraps it up for this week, Eric.
Yeah, thanks to our listeners out there today on DL Minutes. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can pick up the latest episode on your favorite podcast platforms, which include iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. As Sam mentioned, hit us up on Twitter at DLine Minutes with your questions or email us at minutes@doubleline.com, and we'll try and answer them in the topic of the week.
Yeah, you can always check out our website too at doubleline.com. We have a wealth of information on there, including articles and some white papers that you can dig through. Don't forget to subscribe on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/doubleline capital. You can follow me and Jeff at Sherman Show Pod on the X. And did want to thank everyone for tuning in this week. And as always, every week, hope everyone has a good weekend and good luck out there.
This presentation was recorded on the date indicated. Views and opinions expressed herein are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the views of DoubleLine Capital LP, its affiliates, or employees, should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities, and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. The presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media, in any form, without the express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representations or warranties regarding the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this material. Liability, including any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is explicitly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice. The receipt of this presentation by any listener should not be construed as the provision of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual, nor does it imply that such person becomes a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but it does not imply low risk. Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.